So I'm very happy to be here with all of you at Seattle Insight, and thank you for coming on Friday night. So I live in San Francisco, and I know in a big city like Seattle, there are many other alternative activities for you on Friday nights that you could be participating in. But I also particularly appreciate coming to an urban Dharma group like yours. I began my practice also in an urban Dharma group, actually in Cambridge, Massachusetts, at Cambridge Insight Meditation Center. And then I have spent a lot of time in my life also on retreat and in retreat centers and monasteries and things like that, but appreciate very much also practice in regular, normal life. So I live now in San Francisco in a very busy, active neighborhood with bars and movie theaters and dogs and parking problems and all of the different challenges of urban life. And it's a great place to apply our Dharma practice and to see the ways in which we're caught and to try to live a liberated life too. So I thought I would share with you, since this is my first time officially coming to your Sangha, something about my take on the Dharma, if you will. And I know you've had many different teachers coming through here, as well as you have your main teachers here, Rodney and others, teach at Seattle Insight. And you find that different people, including you yourself, if you have practiced for any time, have a different take on the Dharma in some ways. And perhaps it also changes at different times, what it is that strikes you as most in the forefront. And I think that's a good thing. That speaks to, I think, both the depth and beauty of the Dharma, that it's this many-faceted jewel, and that different of us see different sides of it, as well as to the possibility of our own evolution, that at different times, different aspects of the Dharma connect with us more. So for those who I've already lost, because you don't know what it means when I say the Dharma, I'll take a step back and explain a little bit about that. So here we are in this beautiful center here in Nalanda West, and behind me is the statue of the Buddha, who was actually a human being who lived 2,600 years ago in India and had his own existential crisis and then went off in search of understanding, and tried this way and tried that way, and finally came to some understanding through spiritual practice, through use of spiritual technology, if you will, of an understanding about the truth of the way things are. So this is a translation that I like for the Dharma, is both the teachings of the Buddha, but it actually is the teachings of the Buddha that are about the truth. You know, it's about actually the way things are, sort of nature, if you will. So one of the helpful things about this is that it means that this is the truth of the way things are. All of us actually have access to that. So all of us can actually understand that. You know, all of us have the possibility of penetrating that, of seeing that, of actually direct experience of that, because it's there in every moment. It's there in our lives. It's there actually in the experience of our body. It's there in the changing weather, it's there in the buildings, it's there in traffic, it's there in everything. And particularly, actually, it's there in the mind to notice. So the Dharma being the truth of the way things are, I liken this also to, as a metaphor, to some other aspects of the way things are. So for example, the law of gravity. So the law of gravity is something that describes in the physical world the truth of how things are. So for example, if I take this glove and I try to place it in midair, most of you are going to know what's going to happen here, right? So it falls and it hits the ground. So that probably didn't surprise anyone. But supposing I didn't know about that, and I thought like, oh, well, maybe that's, you know, that just happened once, but we'll see if it happens on this side, right? So I try it again, and yeah, same thing happens, right? And you could try it with different objects, right? So this is like a Blistex lip balm, right? So what if I put it higher, right? Or what if I'm not looking, right? Still, it went down, right? Still it fell like that. So then after some time, you get the sense like, oh yeah, this is just seems to be the way things are, and it's not different on different days, and it's not about me, it's not personal to me, you know. So, you know, if I try to place something in midair again, this watch, you know, and it falls, I would just know, like, oh yeah, that's how things are. It's not like, you know, why me? Like, why now? You know, right? So you understand this with gravity, right? It's just gravity. It's just happening like this. It's not personal. It's not a personal thing. It's just a description of the way things are. And so if I understand that, as most of us as adults do, and we start to live our lives in accordance with that, in harmony with that, then we suffer less. We have less messes, yeah? So, you know, if I take this glass of water, if I want to place it, right, in midair, I know it's going to fall. And there'll be water and, you know, if this was floor, broken glass, and a mess to clean up. So then I know, like, okay, if I can place it on the table, then there's less messes. It's as simple as that. And if at some point I make a mistake, place it on the edge and it falls, I don't actually have to spend a lot of time ruminating about it or try. It's like, oh, okay, right, gravity, remember that, put it back up. So like that, right? So the Dharma is just like this. The Dharma is just the truth of the way things are. So how do things play out in life? You know, what is the truth of experience? What is the truth of what leads towards happiness? And what is the truth of what leads towards suffering? What are these laws of the way things work that if we try to run against them, there's friction in our life, there's chaos, there's more dukkha, suffering, right? And what are these laws in which if we actually try to live in harmony with them and live in accordance with them, understanding how things work, then we'll be able to actually lead more harmonious and peaceful lives, both for ourselves and others. So these are the description of the teachings of the Buddhist path, and the techniques of the meditation are actually the practices that help us to realize this on more than an intellectual level, you know, to actually see this in our own experience through paying attention. And they're there all the time for us to see if we pay attention. And we can also get them at different levels of depth as we are able to actually notice in different ways. So among these different teachings, these different understandings about the truth, the way things are, is that in our experiential life, in our life as human beings, what we call our life is actually made up of six different experiences in rapid succession. So in the Buddhist psychology, there's a description of six sense doors that we have. So we have the five sense doors that you learn in kindergarten, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, hearing. And then the sixth sense door is actually the mind. And what we call our life from the time of birth all through existence is just the rapid succession of different experiences in these different sense doors. So there's seeing, there's smelling, there's touching, there's tasting. And they alternate. They alternate so rapidly that actually it seems like they're happening at the same time, but actually it's kind of like, you know, these different frames of the movie. And that's how it is, on and on. So the sixth sense door is actually the mind. And so just as the eye receives sights and the ear receives sounds and the body, through the body we can sense body sensations when there is consciousness present, then the mind also receives thought as a sense impression. And that level of thought can be thinking, planning, memories, all different things. But actually thought is just considered equivalently a sense door, a sense impression. So as long as you're conscious, as long as you're alive, there's a succession of these different experiences. And the first thing that's helpful to notice about them is that they're always changing. So this is the stream of experiences, you know, what we call life. It's this constantly changing stream of experiences. And it's happening so fast. And there's actually no stopping it. You know, there's no stopping, there's no slowing the flow of this endless changing of experiences. So everything that arises in our experience passes away. So this happens on a small scale, moment to moment. Yeah, this happens on a larger scale with relationships, with jobs, with apartments with shoes, with cars, with sandwiches, right? Everything. Everything that comes into being that arises also passes away. So this is a characteristic of our life. This is a characteristic of experiential life. So because everything is always passing away, there's actually no inherent stability in our experience. So there's no place to find a permanent home in experience. There is no stability there. And there's no solidity, actually, to objects and to things and to people. And most importantly, actually, to that which we call ourself, conventionally. So this is true if you reflect even in the half hour of sitting we did here. So from the time you sat down, the beginning is orienting you to connect with your body, feel the body sensations. And then that's passed away. So then probably the attention went to something else. So you noticed a thought, you noticed a sound. Or even if you stayed with the body, different body sensations arose. You can reflect with the thoughts that went through your head. So maybe when you first sat down, you thought about what you've been doing right before you got here. Or you thought about the people here, or you thought about the weather, or you thought about this group or something. And then a different thought came. So there's no thought that stays there permanently either. So you can reflect on your emotions. So you can think about, if you can remember, what mood you were in this morning when you woke up, if you were in any kind of mood. Were you in a good mood or a bad mood? Happy? Were you grumpy? Angry? Were you excited? And then you could remember at different times during the day if there was a different mood that became predominant. So it's probably not the same mood that's here now. Or even if in a certain conventional way we call it the same mood, like, oh, I've been angry all day, there probably have been different pitches of that anger. Yeah. It's waxed and waned a little bit. It's come and gone a little bit. It's gotten stronger, it's gotten weaker. Sometimes there's points at which we actually forgot about it, maybe too. Right? And then we remembered, oh yeah, I'm angry today, right? Go back. Right? So emotions constantly changing. Thoughts are constantly changing. The physical body is constantly changing. So, and yet we find that ourselves looking for stability in experience. And so then here comes the third characteristic, which is that of dukkha, so unsatisfactoriness of experience. So noticing the ways in which we seek happiness through experience. We seek happiness in trying to line up experiences. So we try to make everything be good for us, basically. And in this flow of different experiences, there is a variety of pleasant experiences, unpleasant experiences, neither, sort of neutral experiences. But for most of us, our recipe for happiness is, I'm going to try and get as many pleasant, good experiences as possible, and I'm going to try and block out as many unpleasant experiences as possible. And when I get all pleasant experiences and no unpleasant experiences, then I'll be happy and I'll try and keep it like that. So if you consider, for example, in your life, there's different areas of your life. So you could say maybe your family and your friends, your health, your job, your love life, maybe your creative life, could include your, if you have a car, your automotive life, your home, the state of politics, you know, you could pick, like, what are your top 10 categories that are important to you, right? And then notice how our usual strategy for happiness is, if we want to rate them on, you know, 0 to 10, 10 being the best, I would like them all to get to 10, and then I would like to keep them there, you know, forever. And actually the truth of life is that they're all kind of dancing around, right? So sometimes your job is good, but your neighbors are difficult. And sometimes your relationship is going really well, but you're not so healthy. Or sometimes your car is broken down, but you're actually really feeling very creative or something like that. So this is just life. It's like it's always these ones kind of dancing up and down in these different levels. I was just at the Experience Music Project here this morning. I was playing with their graphic equalizer thing. You could pretend to be a mixer, you know. And it's really like we want to take everything to 10, you know, all of this, and like keep it there at 10, right? And find some way to magically make none of them go down. And it's actually very poignant to notice oneself doing this because, you know, it would be a good idea if it actually worked, you know, if it was actually possible for it to work. But the thing is that in this flow of changing experience where things are not in our control, it's just not going to work. You know, it's just actually like a doomed strategy for success, which is really the only thing that's wrong with it. It's like a doomed strategy. Like it's not aligned, you know? It's just not aligned with the way things are. I mean, it really is like, you know, trying to build the house in midair, you know, like gravity is going to pull it down. It's just not going to work. So I think it's helpful to consider the Dharma like this. It's not an esoteric thing out there. You know, it's not something that was just figured out by this guy 2,600 years ago because he thought about things. And, you know, there's some descriptions of Dharma that are more complex, and there are different levels of nuance for sure as we become more familiar and as we tap into and try to understand things. But it's helpful to know, though, that this is actually a description of reality. This is a description of what is true. And so all of us actually, by tuning in, by paying attention, can connect with this more and more and can actually align ourselves more and more with this. So another esoteric term that is difficult to understand sometimes is like enlightenment. You know, it sounds like a very like unusual foreign word, enlightenment. And maybe another way to think about that is actually about alignment. So someone who is completely enlightened is actually someone who's fully aligned in this way with the way things are. So they're fully in harmony like that. And so thus there's no more suffering for them, because they're completely living in harmony with that. So there's been a realization and an alignment. So actually the word dukkha, this word for suffering or strain, is also describes the way that like a wheel, the potter's wheel, this is the ancient metaphor, it's like a potter's wheel that's slightly off. So it's going around and it's like, right? It's like going around, but it's not totally smooth. Like a wheel where like where the axle doesn't totally fit, so it's like a little bumpy here, like that. Or the modern equivalent, I think, of this is like if we're in a cafe and you're at a table and one of the legs is shorter than the other or something, right? So you sit there, you have the coffee, and it's like, you know, the table's like that. And at first you don't notice that there's something going on, right? And then, you know, someone else puts the elbow on the table and goes, right. So it's like this about life, you know. It's like this, the dukkha. And this is the out of alignment. And sometimes it's this little one, like the cafe, and sometimes it's really like a sledgehammer. You know, sometimes the dukkha is just so strong and so big and so apparent there, right? Death, right? Death happening or separation or big crises in health or any of this, right? A loss of job or loss of loved one or divorce. You know, there's so many things that are actually big time dukkha, you know. But then also all the time there's this small scale going on, okay, this smaller scale dukkha going on like this, right? part of the alignment too that I feel like is helpful to bring to mind, particularly for us who are living regular lay lives, is about the training precepts. So the precepts that the Buddha described and in the teachings, there are basically encouragements for us to experiment with them, to take them on as trainings, to attend to these particularly powerful areas of human life, of activity, and to learn about cause and effect. And as we learn about these things, then we come more and more into alignment. So actually the precepts are both our trainings on the way towards becoming fully aligned or awakened people, but they're also actually the description of how someone acts when they are fully aligned, so naturally. So a human being who actually already understands the truth of interconnection to such a deep level is actually impossible to kill another human being. Right? To destroy life does not feel in alignment. To take what is not offered, the root of which is greed, then, you know, to be obsessed by greed and craving and act on that. To believe in the experiential world enough to believe that if I get that thing, that will make me happy, and I must have that, which is the driving force behind that impulse. So that's also out of alignment when that happens. So the precept around sexuality, against it, attending to the way in which we play out our sexuality in the world. So this is a combination of the first and the second, actually, about noticing intention to harm versus non-harming, and noticing grasping energy, like greed, as it comes up, versus generosity, renunciation, gentleness. So sexuality can be such a powerful force, both for positive, for healing, with love, but also has been such a damaging force for so many of us. Has caused so much harm and pain. So attending to ourselves in this area, which is just a natural part of our humanity. So noticing the alignment, or when we're out of alignment there. Noticing in the area of speech. So this is a very helpful one, because some people hear the first three and think like, oh yeah, I'm okay really in these areas. But for most people, you speak fairly often. Right. There's a lot of opportunities for noticing nuances of alignment or misalignment. And noticing about truth-telling, or when we're drawn into saying what's not true, and what's the intention behind that? Why are we doing that? That includes even exaggeration. So noticing if we're drawn to like make something seem bigger or better or more numbers than it is. Like, why is that? Noticing when we speak with an intention of harming, so harsh, abusive speech. And noticing cause and effect there. Noticing when we use speech that has this intention, divisiveness, or gossip, slander. Or probably the most nuanced of them is noticing when we speak when we don't need to speak. The English translation of that one is often like idle chatter, but it's basically unnecessary speech, which could be, when you pay attention to it, actually a lot of the time. But even just wondering like, well, what does that mean, idle chatter? What does that mean, unnecessary speech? And then the fifth area of training is paying attention to the effect on our mind and body of intoxicants that cloud the mind, so alcohol and drugs. So again, it's a very practical teaching of the Dharma. So to me, this is primarily around attending to the effect this has, particularly on doing things that we later regret, doing things that are harmful to ourselves and others. So many times people who, during normal times, might have the best intentions of following the first four precepts I mentioned, under the influence of something that clouds their mind, might do things that later we / they regret. So it's just noticing cause and effect like that. So now the title that I gave for this talk, which I feel I should speak about since it was mentioned as a title, is about catching the right thought train. It's actually on this road towards alignment and towards understanding, you know, what is it that leads to happiness and what leads towards suffering. You know, in our practice, it's helpful to pay attention to all these different areas that I mentioned. But a particular place to pay attention is in the mind. So paying attention to the mind and the heart. There's actually, with meditation, even though we put our body in a certain posture and so on, it's actually an activity of awareness. It's an activity of the mind. And noticing what it is that leads towards harmony, happiness, and what leads towards suffering. Dukkha. So the Buddha was a spiritual practitioner, as I mentioned, and I like a lot reading the stories and the suttas about his own spiritual practice. And he describes in these teachings about his own path. And Buddha was actually a very, very amazingly intelligent person. So, you know, Bonnie told you about my impressive education and so on. And I would say I've met many, many smart people in my life, but Buddha was a genius. This guy was really a genius. So one of the experiments that he did in his time as a spiritual practitioner, as he was trying to unravel this puzzle of suffering and the end of suffering, is he did at some point this thought experiment. So this is described in a sutta called Two Kinds of Thought, which is actually in the book Majjhima Nikaya. So it's number 19, I believe it is. So he said, well, what if I divide my thoughts into two different categories? So there's a little experiment here. So I'm going to pay attention. I'm going to notice, you know, when are there thoughts that are thoughts of sensual desire, ill will, and cruelty? That's one category. And when are there thoughts that are thoughts of renunciation, of non-ill will, or goodwill, metta is kindness, non-cruelty, compassion. And I'm going to just pay attention to what happens when each of these different categories of thought arises. So what happens in my mind? What happens when I act from these? What happens to me? What happens to other people? You know, so kind of mapping out, like, what plays out. So he started to notice, and then he tracked. He was like, oh, when these states arise of sensual desire, this greed, of ill will, of cruelty. Actually, this leads to pain and suffering for myself in the mind. It leads to pain and suffering for others, and actually for both of us. And then when this other category of thoughts arise, it actually does not lead to those places. It actually leads to positive states for myself and others, positive actions. So he tracks like this, and then he notices this, and then it's like, oh, okay, so when these ones come up, greed, ill will, cruelty, then those are ones that it's helpful to let go of. So don't cultivate those, and don't act on those. And then when these ones come up, these are really helpful ones, actually. So cultivate those. You know, go with them when they come up. And then he noticed also that he could affect the stream of his mind in this way. So he noticed, oh, whatever you think and ponder upon, this becomes the inclination of your mind. So that we're actually trainable. So the contents of our mind is not just accidental like this, like it's actually cause and effect. We actually plant seeds in our life through the thoughts that we have, what we surround ourselves with, and we cultivate these different states. So it's helpful to think about this, like, what am I cultivating? You know, what am I planting in this garden, right? What seeds am I planting? So the more that we, for example, will, if we have thoughts of anger, that we nurture those along and kind of add fuel to that fire, then we're actually strengthening that as a possibility of arising in the mind. You know, we're basically strengthening that habit. We're cultivating that habit. And then the more that we try to cultivate generosity or kindness, compassion, then we're actually strengthening that habit. So it's more likely to arise spontaneously. It's more likely to be the inclination of our mind. So this is also just the natural law. You know, this is the truth of the way things are, too, to notice that. And it's not really in our control in the moment what it is that arises. So as you're sitting here, something arises, but then it's helpful to try to notice that and notice, like, is this something I want to cultivate or not cultivate? So I was in Sri Lanka, where my extended family lives, over the holiday time. And I have one living grandparent who is now my grandma, who's 91, who's there, who I got to visit. And so she lives in a kind of assisted living place with other elderly people. And it's really interesting to see, you know, at that stage of life, how people are, who are like, you know, they pretty much let go of most social niceties and, you know, kind of veneers and things like that. So it's sort of like you get the unadulterated mind, you know, stream being communicated. And you can see, like, the different states of mind that are going through different people. And then you know, as you visit with the different residents there, you know, what that must be like for them in the moment. You know, those who are more bitter or angry or fearful, and that comes through as the predominant stream of mind. Or those who, even though they don't know what day it is, or they don't remember, you know, significant logistical information, seem actually like very happy and generous, you know, and that's the predominant stream of their mind. So seeing that was very affected me, to see like, oh yeah, look how this happens like this, you know, and both to consider, well, what kind of mind would you like to have now, right? And if you do live a little so long, you know, what kind of mind would you like to have in the future, like that? What kind of mind would you like to subject those around you to, right? So the helpful thing is that we can actually train. We can train our mind like this. Right? So the metaphor of the thought trains is actually related to also some experience I had in Sri Lanka. So I spent some time after college in Sri Lanka practicing Dharma and going living in different monasteries, and I did some community development work also there, and I practiced with different Dharma teachers and so on. And as I mentioned, my parents are from Sri Lanka, but I was born and raised in the U.S. And we spent time in the summers there, so I knew conversationally how to speak, but I couldn't really read or write very well in Sinhalese, one of the languages there. So, but I really wanted to practice there, so I spent time there and ended up taking the bus around to go to different Dharma centers. And most of them were in like very remote areas. But the buses often had the signs written in Sinhalese and not in English. And so when I first got there, I could actually only read at the level of like maybe a first grader. So I'd read very slowly. And the names of the buses are written in the front really big, but each of the characters represents a sound. So the bus would be coming towards me, and I have to decide, like, oh, is this my bus or not? And you kind of have to flag the bus down or it goes, right? So I'd have to be like, ko, lo, and then, poof, you know. The bus was gone. I couldn't read fast enough to figure out, like, is that my bus? Is it not my bus? Do I want to go there? You know, so then the next one would be like, nu, wa, and poof, right? Go on again. So it was difficult. So then I started to, you know, I'd guess the first letter I could read, and then I'd flag it down and then get in and then try and read. And like, oh no, it's not my bus. Sometimes I was lucky and it would be, you know. So I ended up going, you know, getting on the wrong bus a lot and going to someplace I didn't want to be. And then, you know, it was very confusing. But then gradually, as I started to be there longer and I got some help from my cousins and I started to learn the language better, so I could read much more fluently. So then I could see when the bus came, was coming towards me, like, oh yeah, okay, Kalamba, okay, that's my bus, flag it, get on, ride the bus to the destination. Like, oh, Galaha, oh, that's not my bus, let it go by, don't get on that bus. Yeah. So then it became, you know, much easier to travel there. So you could think, if you will, that you're, as you're sitting here, you know, your own heart is like this train station, bus station, you will. Right? And these different streams of thought, these different trains of thought are coming through all the time as you're sitting there. And usually the untrained mind, the untrained heart, we just get on basically every train that comes through. Right? So that's the story with most human beings. We're just subject to just getting on whatever the train is. And then we end up at whatever destination. And it may or may not be some place that we want to be in our mind, in our heart, in our life. So then we're just subject to what the patterns are of those trains. So it could be that one will go by and you could imagine this from your life, even from the sitting here. Suddenly you're in some memory of being in grade school and, you know, being taunted and something like that, right? And being scared and ashamed and things like that. So that didn't go to a good place, but we didn't know and we got on that train, like, oh, what's going on here? Or another one will come up and it will be the jealousy train. You know, something reminds us of like our ex or something, and then, you know, get very jealous and think about this and obsessive and stuff. And then, you know, you end up in a place that you don't want to be. It's like this, you know, metaphorically, like this burned out landscape with, you know, like burning trash cans and dark, you know, it's a bad neighborhood. You don't want to go there on that train. But we get on the train and we go there, like without knowing. But then conversely, there are beautiful ones that come. So sometimes we get on a train, it's actually a train of kindness or generosity. You know, and you can notice this in yourself and others too when that comes, and it's beautiful. It's really beautiful. It goes to a very good place. And notice what it's like there too. So part of our training here in the practice, you know, it's the practice of mindfulness, cultivating presence, this awareness practice, is basically learning how to read, you know, in some ways, learning how to read, you know, what are the states that are coming through in my mind and my heart? And is this actually one that is going towards a place that leads towards happiness, harmony? Is it one that is not? So which is it that I would like to be on? Which thought train would I like to be on, so to speak? And in the beginning, it is very difficult to do this. So it's like I was describing, you know, with reading the signs on the buses, where we don't know until we're way down the tracks. And then we realize, like, oh yeah, oh, this does not feel good. This is not good. This is the revenge train. Like, oh, I don't want to be there. Right? So then, okay, good. We learn that. We feel it. And part of the learning in this is actually feeling what it feels like. So we have to learn this, you know, in so many different ways. Like actually in the body. You know, what does it feel like in the body? Like, what does it feel like in the heart? What does it feel like in the mind? You know? And we can start to learn to read this like sooner and sooner. You know, like we don't have to be in the total fire of that intense revenge before, like, you know, that landscape before we realize. We can start to realize, like, in the beginning of that, right? When we're about to take this, oh, okay, let that go. And then the other side, too, like, it's actually very helpful to bring awareness to when these states like generosity, like kindness, joy, when these arise, like, acclimatize your body to what that feels like. You know, bring awareness in the mind. Like, allow yourself to completely inhabit that state too. Like, know what that feels like. So that also provides a contrast to you when you start to get on the jealousy train, the revenge train. You know, you can feel like, oh yeah, this is not the joy and compassion express. This is like, right? Because you can feel the difference. Because you know what it's like for this openness. Right? So we can train ourselves, you know, more and more to read these states and then, you know, there's a whole, of course, like practice and understanding how to get off the train, right, when you're on it. But as we do this, as we learn this more and more, then we get on less and less of the trains that are running in the direction we don't want to go. And then actually, like in any train station, if nobody's getting on the train, they stop running them as often. And then basically, eventually they'll stop running at all. And this is the possibility of uprooting greed, hatred, confusion, delusion from our mind, which is totally possible for us here and now in the 21st century, living in urban setting and wherever it is, whoever you are. You know, it's not just an esoteric teaching from 2600 years ago. So part of the genius, I think, of the Buddha's teaching is that the human mind is fundamentally still the same. So even though we have all kinds of different technology and transportation and internet and so on, the descriptions of the way the mind works the truth of the way things are is fundamentally still the same. So we can actually use these different practices and the understanding from the teaching to explore our own experience. So I encourage you to check it out yourself. You know, basically the only way that this works for you is to make this your own. You know, see if this is really true, that which I've been describing to you. You know, if you like this metaphor of paying attention to the heart, the mind as a train station, do that when you sit. Like, okay, what are the predominant, you know, what's my train schedule like, right? You know, like probably if you go to the train station here, there's common places the train goes, right? Portland, Vancouver or something, right? You see what's the most common one. So what's the most common ones in your own landscape? Yeah. And what are uncommon ones? And here's where it's, you know, in spiritual practice, it's really helpful to be, you know, very honest with yourself. You know, even if you feel like, oh, I'm actually, when I actually sit and look at my experience, when I pay attention, I'm actually really embarrassed to notice, like, how jealous I am or something. You know. But try to hold yourself with compassion as you notice what's actually there. But actually try to be very honest with yourself, you know. Like, it's very helpful to make a pledge to yourself, a vow to yourself, to try to be as honest as possible, to see as truthfully as possible what is actually there. Because only then can you actually work with that, deal with that, transform that. Otherwise, pretending things aren't there, or, you know, trying to be a pretend spiritual person who's never jealous, like, it doesn't really work. And then also the extent to which we can notice what's there and open to that ourselves is the extent to which we can also see that, bear with that, and hold others in compassion when we can see that they're caught in that state too. So I can't say that you know, it will happen like this, but maybe it will happen like this. But the possibility of transformation is there, and really guided by your own sense of interest, and hopefully your sense of regard for yourself and for others, can allow this to be the motivation for your practice. Because actually, what else is there to do? I'll stop there with my talk part. Thank you for your attention this evening. And actually, open up if people have questions they want to ask about anything that I said, or also any other questions or challenges come up for you. I'll see if I can share something that's helpful. And thank you, Chris, for running the mic around.
Sometimes the resentment and envy killing is more juicy.
Sorry, say
sometimes
that again.
Sometimes the resentment and envy killing is more juicy.
Yeah.
And the joy and generosity could at times be boring after a few times.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
I'd love to know how balance that.
Yeah, so I haven't heard that question. Yeah, you know, it's really interesting to notice that, right? And yet on a certain level, we know, like, oh, that's not that's not where I want to live in the resentment train, but it does seem to be more interesting in some way, or, you know, energetic. And it's good to explore that too, because that is probably part of why it's sticky, like part of why we're going there so much more, right? Is there something in there that's like energy or interesting or something? Right? But you can see this is true in different people's lives too. And, you know, you could relate to this maybe from your own life, or maybe you have friends who this describes, that like you could have a lot of drama in your life. You know, you could constantly be getting into conflicts with people and dramas and things like that. And then, you know, it seems like something is going on. Something is going on. But then, actually, like, is that something that's going on good? And is that the way that you want your life to be? So, and of course, like, a lot of the teachings of the Dharma, even though it's the truth of the way things are, it's kind of countercultural. So, for example, like, when you watch a TV show or a movie, like, it's all about drama. So it's all about drama. Like, you wouldn't watch a TV show if it's just people sitting there, right? It wouldn't be interesting. So there's some conflict, and people are doing things, and, you know, right, like, cheating on each other, and this and that, and it's, like, all, right, there's something to, like, pay attention to, like, get engaged in. So notice this, like, the drama tendency of your own mind, you know? Like, notice this drama tendency of your own mind. And I think partly it's related to sometimes even that precept around, like, idle chatter. So sometimes we're uncomfortable with the state of quiet or peace or something like that. Or one of the teachings of the Dharma is also that, you know, before we are completely aligned, we actually misconstrue things a lot. So we take for permanent things that are impermanent. You know, we take for actually beautiful things that are unbeautiful. We take for we take things the wrong way, basically. Like, we misperceive things. So this is like one of those examples. Is like we misperceive this resentment train as actually like a positive thing in some ways. So it takes more attention, like getting interested in it. You know, being like, okay, what is this actually really like? You know, what is this particularly like? Notice the agitation of mind that might be there. Notice the sense of separation. This is a helpful place to notice is when there's a sense of sometimes you're going along and there's just a sense of unity or cohesion or okayness, and then something arises and there's a resentment. And actually, if you can notice that moment of the separation when there's like self and other to engage in resentment with, that is a very interesting moment to notice too. Yeah. Or same thing with greed. It's sort of going along and then suddenly there's something that's perceived as like an object, and then there's this desire. There's like this desire, actually desire itself sort of creates this tension, this object. And it's drama. It's drama that it sometimes seems like, oh, that energy is appealing. So it's really helpful to investigate that. Like, what is that there? What's in that there? So I'll say a few more things about the possibilities of that, but it's all like to investigate. So one is that in that arising, there's this rising of self in that moment. There's a rising of self in that resentment. Like either in that antipathy towards someone, or even in the other one I said of like greed or lust or something like that, and we're like addicted to this arising of self. So even though it's actually not true, it's like this fictitious structure. We're used to it, you know. We're used to it, like we're comfortable with it, and we're afraid of the spaciousness or the emptiness of that not being there. And so, like, we keep doing that. Like, we keep doing that. But it's very interesting to look at that. And different people will notice, you know, as you start to pay attention, like, of your particular thought trains that are common, like, what are the ones that are really addictive for me? So, for example, some people find anger to be very addictive. And they know, like, oh, I don't want to be, like, a rageful person. But then they find themselves, like, in that so much of the time. And sometimes you could notice, yeah, okay, there's this part that's the hatred part, and it's like, that part doesn't feel good. But there also is this sense of power. You know, anger also brings this energy and a sense of powerfulness that actually I like. And it makes me feel strong. It makes me feel like I won't be hurt in this way. And most of these unwholesome mind states, I would say, are basically like the unenlightened mind's best guess at a strategy for happiness. Yeah. Like in a world, you know, to like perceive this world of like dichotomies and then it's like throwing up, you know, some like, okay, this. Right? And for example, resentment, like resentment happens, when does resentment happen? When something happens that's unpleasant, right? Something happens that you don't like. So someone says something you don't like, or, right, example. So it's actually very funny when you think about it that way. So something unpleasant arises in experience, and then the unenlightened mind is like, what to do? I'll hate it, you know? It's like it doesn't actually change the unpleasantness of that. It doesn't, you know, it's like a completely unnecessary, like, add-on of dukkha and yet that's the best strategy. So it's just like, so just really like holding with compassion, I think, the mind as it does that, as we notice it doing that, and getting really interested in, and really honest with yourself about like, what is actually here? You know, what is actually sticky about this? And investigating that. So there's a lot to be learned from that too. Thank you.
So, the equalizer striving for ends and cultivating the good.
What's the difference between cultivating the good and the equalizer, the graphic equalizer I was suggesting? So the in the metaphor I was using of striving for 10, it was about like experiential life in a certain way, right? So usually you think like, if I had a great house and if I had, you know, a great car and if I had, like all these things, and then if that was true forever, if I had a great relationship, if my kids did what I wanted, if my boss was good, right, then it would be permanently good. So you're saying in the experience of the internal life, is it not the same? Is that what you're asking me?
Well, I'm cultivating good. There's a quality that depends from
you going on. So the mic has come back to you.
So in my mind, or in thinking about this,
yeah.
It's that kind of shifting from the Mercedes.
Right.
Right.
Right. So it's good to notice the relationship can be to anything, including to spiritual practice or you know, whatever it is. But then you're back in, so the train that you're on then is the striving train. And maybe it's the striving train about being aligned or awakened or good or whatever, you know, but still is the striving train. It actually doesn't matter what the object is. So you know, it's tricky, so then it's good to notice, like, oh, this is striving. This is actually counter to that. This is what it is now, so feel that. That's actually not the train I want to be on. In fact, the striving train goes to the opposite side, right? Yeah. So noticing that and not getting duped by, you know, what seems like, oh, a good goal, but I'm striving towards it or something like that. Does that make sense? Yeah. And a lot of it is actually feeling, like I feel like it's very helpful to notice the feeling in the body, you know, towards that. Because it can be true for anything, that energy, you know, the energy of these unskillful states, if you will, unwholesome states, or that which go towards disharmony. As they arise, we can actually feel that in our body. You can feel that in your mind. And I feel like in many ways with practice, it's like developing a more and more refined and sensitive system, like becoming more and more aware sooner and sooner of when that comes up. Yeah. Kind of akin to like, you know, if you're walking around and you have rocks in your shoes, you know, and then you notice that, and it's like, oh, I gotta stop and take these rocks out of my shoes. So you knock them out, and then you're walking, and it's like, oh, there's actually pebbles in my shoes. Oh, there's still pebbles. And then you take them out, and then walking around, it's like, oh, there's sand in my shoes. And you take that out, right? So when there was still sand and pebbles in your shoes, when there was rocks in your shoes, but you didn't notice it because there's giant rocks in your shoes. So, you know, that was predominant. But then once you take those out, then you notice the more subtle ones, and then you notice the more subtle ones, and so on. So you can start to notice this on more and more subtle levels until it actually is like just when the very beginning is like, you know, starting to rear its, you know, here's craving, like, and like, okay, hatred, okay, And it's not actually like, if you think about, well, what is it that's doing that? It actually is wisdom, you know. It actually is wisdom that's doing that. So it's not actually stress, striving, and hating them that's doing it, you know. It's not like whack-a-mole, like, you know. So it's being very patient and actually interested in the process, I think, is helpful to you. I mean, partly I share this metaphor in this landscape because this is a part of the teaching, and this is the path. And I think in the way that Vipassana is often taught, which I appreciate very much, is about mindfulness and about bare attention, but not always emphasizing all these other aspects of it too. So the mindfulness, bare attention, knowing what is actually here, but then there is a cultivation that happens, you know, where we, the path is actually going towards this uprooting of these different mind states. Yeah. So I think it's helpful to know that, but it also is helpful to know how to skillfully work with your own experience too. So being able to be open to know, to be compassionate towards whatever it is that's happening, and also whatever, wherever it is that you are. Any particular dimension of that, or just how to work with that physical pain?
Well, I understand part about noticing what happens when you feel that pain, and then as you get deeper into that, what would you see about pain?
What does one see about pain? Have you worked with pain?
Physical pain. Yeah.
The danger of asking questions, I might ask you a question back, of course.
Well, it's not just sitting on the back there, so I'm talking about things.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is also a part of the truth of the way things are, is that particularly with physical pain, you know, we are animals. Like, our physical body is an animal incarnation. And as soon as we take birth, we're subject to getting sick, and people are born in different states of health. Some are already sick from the time they're young and experiencing a lot of pain, but none of us can escape that. Like, none of us can escape physical pain. So it's just true, and it's difficult. It's a difficult part of existence in this realm, physical pain. So part of the practice is noticing, you know, what is our relationship to that? Like, what is our relationship to physical pain when it arises? You know, both on a moment-to-moment level and also just as a whole phenomenon, you know, about physical pain arising. For example, you know, do we feel like this is a betrayal of my body? You know, like, my body is betraying me in some way. Like, or some other version of, like, this should not be like this. So that this should not be like this is a little bit like we're talking about with that resentment, where there is difficult sensation in the body, you know, unpleasantness, pain, if you will. And so what is our relationship to that? You know, what is the best way to relate to that? And not knowing what to do with it, again, the unenlightened mind, unawakened mind, can throw up, like, resentment, or it shouldn't be like this, or making up stories about why it is like that, or, you know, basically a lot of mental friction that adds to the suffering of the physical body. So it's actually helpful to note that in this state of alignment or awakening, enlightenment, whatever you have it, physical pain will not be removed. So this is actually kind of a disappointing thing to hear, but you still are incarnated in a physical body, and so if you get stabbed by something, that would be physical pain there. The thing that will be not there is actually the whole mental affluence of suffering that come along with that. So the physical body will be harmed, and there will be physical sensations, but it will not be have the same experience in the mind import, right? Because of our relationship to that. So noticing that, you know, practicing every time that we have physical pain is really helpful. You know, noticing, like, what is my relationship to that? And then holding with compassion whatever it is, the patterns that arise with that, you know, to whatever extent we're able to work with that. It's also helpful to notice with physical pain, you know, it can be very tiring, particularly with chronic pain or something like that. Like, it can be very difficult to be with that in any kind of extended way. So this is also part of skillful practice, is to notice that and then to try to hold with compassion and then to work skillfully with that. So sometimes it is helpful to actually turn your attention to something else, you know, not to be with that all the time. Turn your attention to something more neutral, or even just give yourself a break from that too. But it is both a sobering thing and a truth of the way things are that we cannot escape physical pain. Nobody can, you know, like no matter how rich you are or good looking you are or famous you are, you know, that's part of our human incarnation. Now the other side of things, you could regard physical pain as sometimes being helpful to you because it basically kicks you in the pants, literally actually sometimes, right? It's like, wake up, dukkha, remember? Suffering, difficulty, strain, stress. So in the Buddhist teaching, they also are, talk of like different realms. So there's actually like higher realms, you know, sort of deva realms, and there's lower realms, like hell realms and human realms. And the human realm is actually considered the best place to be for awakening, for spiritual practice, because you get a mix of pleasure and pain. So it's not so miserable like the hell realms that you can't like, you know, poke your head up to get any air or do anything, you know, else besides suffer. But also, interestingly, in these higher realms, these deva realms, it's considered like so pleasant, there's absolutely no incentive for anyone to do any kind of introspection or anything. It's just all good all the time for long, long periods of time until actually the very end of their eons of life in which they slightly start to smell bad and then quickly pass away, right? So from this perspective, you can consider, and you can remember this near life too, like probably when things are going really great is not when people are driven to spiritual practice, right? It's not when people are like, oh, what's it all about? How can I, you know? It's usually when something difficult happens that we tend to pay attention more. So in this way, you can consider that our helpful spiritual teacher too. So maybe we'll just sit for a few moments to end our evening together. So appreciating the opportunity to hear the teachings of liberation. Appreciating our Sangha, our community here. And appreciating our own wholesome qualities that have brought us here this evening. We share the blessings from our practice here and our activities with everyone else here, with all of our loved ones, with all those who are suffering in the world, and with all beings everywhere. May we all be strong and healthy. May we all be peaceful and happy. May we all be safe. May we all be free from suffering. Thank you for your attention this evening.